Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, this is What's Next, an hour dedicated to amplifying the voices of marginalized and underrepresented communities across Western New York and Southern Ontario.
We cannot erase, we cannot reform, we cannot make things better if we're uncomfortable having tough conversations,
Absolutely.
If we're uncomfortable
Absolutely.
Talking about race.
What's Next carries forward our mission to engage in meaningful conversations about race, equity, and the shared concerns that deeply affect Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
Don't stop. Make those families part of your life. Their lives are part of yours. Don't stop.
Together, we dive into the real issues, striving for understanding, connection, and change.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
This is What's Next from Buffalo, Toronto Public Media. My name is Jay Moran. Pleased to be along with you today and pleased to be on location here in a beautiful studio, a very comfortable setting here with Stephen Rosenthal and Stephen McKinley Henderson, co-producers of It Is Up to Us. Gentlemen, thanks for having us.
Great to have you here and great to be able to do this with my friend Stephen.
Let's get into the background here. Stephen Rosenthal, you started this project, what, 5 years ago about?
Yeah, I had been doing a lot of reading, and I'm old and I like learning new stuff because I've forgotten the old stuff. And one of the books I read was by Heather McGee called The Sum, S-U-M, of Us. And the basic thesis was that not only is racism bad for the targets of racism, it's bad for the society which allows that to exist. And that if we didn't have racism, we could have nice things, whether it was healthcare for all or childcare or for universities, as so many other advanced societies in this world do have. And I finished reading that and went, I'm a documentary filmmaker. I have to make this film. Mm. And the next thought was, what right do I have as a white, middle-aged, now old white guy talking about things that most people don't know about the actual history? And that if we knew what was in black and white, the actual laws, the actual photographs, the actual history, we would behave differently as human beings. You know, it's easy to hate somebody that you don't know. But when you realize that, for example, Black Lives Matter literally did not matter, and that's in the documentary, and Steve was much more modest than should be about his participation here, but the wisdom and the balance that Steve brings to it, and the thing that you've said most, talk about history.
Oh yes, well that's the thing. I mean, if we allow someone to take away our history, if they're doing that, it's because they don't want us to know something. Mm-hmm. They don't want us to know when the footprints in the sand went this way before and what the result of that was. So we won't know where we are if we don't know history. And so there are plenty of warning signs in history, things that we have experienced that we know we don't want to repeat. And but anyone is taking away your history is really taking away something. And there's no reason to fear history. It's there for your benefit to be aware of where things are today. Now, when Stephen reached out to me, and usually because I'm in an organization in New York, a theater organization called the Labyrinth Theater, and there's playwright Stephen Adley Agirgis. And so whenever both of us are in the room, I'm McKinley. So it's perfectly all right to refer to him as Stephen and me as McKinley. But so he reached out to me because of an actor, a mutual friend of ours, Philip Noser. And he said to Stephen, he said, you know, you should get in touch with McKinley because this is something that is up his alley. And when he reached out to me, I assumed that it was to be help as a narrator because he said he already had a documentary. And then he let me see what he had. And that was just so inspiring to see what he had done already. The people, the experts that he had, accumulated, who were expressing incredibly profound and insightful and enlightening data about where this country got its origin. And I was very fortunate in high school. I had a great history teacher, and he was a very important telling us about making sure we got our history from original source material. That we read Carter G. Woodson, Lerone Bennett Jr., John Hope Franklin, and then the materials that those historians were drawing from. And that's what ignited me. I had just, as a matter of fact, when he reached out to me, it was just after I had completed doing this film, Civil War, and it airs right now, you know. And it was a British filmmaker who I'd worked with before and who was director of this project. And I remember him telling me how much he loved America, that as a child growing up in England, that the idea of America, what it meant to so many people in the world, of this place where there was this fresh beginning, this where things were starting, and it had this great potential, especially for human liberty. And he was alarmed at where things were going. That he said that he said it's no longer that. And this was a couple of years ago. So I really did. When Stephen reached out to me, I was on a break while shooting that film when the Topps murders occurred. Hmm. And the city was really devastated. And mm-hmm. then it was wonderful the way the city came together. And I said to myself, because I'm not a cynic at all. I try to call myself a revolutionary optimist. I got that from Amiri Baraka. He said, you know, in times like this, optimism is a revolutionary act. And it's very important for us to believe as revolutionaries do, that change is possible. Mm-hmm. So I was just hoping that we would remain together, that we would hold together as a community. But I love this city. I have to be careful when I tell people that I grew up in Kansas City, because, you know, around football season. But I grew up in Kansas City, Kansas. I want to say that. I didn't grow up in Kansas City, Missouri. But, you know, it's just the Missouri River. But again, history was at the beginning of it all, because Kansas entered as a free state, Missouri as a slave state. And to be a border town, to be on that river, and to understand life in this small town, Kansas City, Kansas, and then across the river there, where everything's up to date in Kansas City, it's a big town, you know, and everything. But it was very clear that there were different mentalities running the area, and at a different point of view about human beings and their interaction. I've always been aware that there are two Americas. There were two Americas. People talk about theater and they say, well, you know, there's this black theater, and they say, well, why is there a black theater? Because there were two Americas. And culturally speaking, the art forms, and you know, they are about the families and the lives of people, the theatrical art form. And so, and we talk about the music, the Colored Musicians Union here, that history, it's a rich history. So anyway, I don't want to go on too much about that, but I was so glad when Stephen gave me an opportunity to be a part of something that I thought could make a difference, just to make people know that this is the real skinny here. This is the real deal. We're not making up any of this. None of this is propaganda. It's not on anybody's side. It's just the history. Straight no chaser. And it is up to us whether or not we want to allow the progress we've made to diminish. Because and so I needed something to do. I needed, after the Topps murders, I needed something to be a part of that I felt could help. It's not a time to be quiet, and it's not a time to be afraid to simply speak the truth. And people, historians go to great lengths to make certain that they have the actual stuff. So it people keep doing scholarship, you know, it piles upon itself. But we can't allow institutions that really do attempt to give us the truth to be quieted. We just can't allow it. So anyhow, Stephen gave me an opportunity to be a part of something that he had been doing that's just, I think, quite important. And it's the drink poured neat. It's really the drink poured neat. And these wonderful contributors, some of whom I knew, some many whom I didn't know. It's an impressive array of Buffalo citizens and national figures who make this, who are part of this documentary.
Stephen McKinley Henderson, you've given me a couple of things that are noted that I want to get back to, because you did something I love. You broke off on tangents just a little bit, and then there's some things I want to explore, and we're going to try to get back to that later on. But I want to stay on what you mentioned about Stephen Rosenthal's efforts as a documentarian, collecting all of this information, all of this footage, all of this these interviews. So, Stephen, how much? I mean, it's always fascinating to see a documentary. You get what you get in the final piece, but how much is left behind? How much did you go through to put together the final product
here? Great question. Part of it is that two fundamental things as a person who wants to make documentaries. One is that if you know how it's going to turn out, it's not a documentary, it's a propaganda piece. And so you have to constantly be open to what's here that I didn't realize. The work that goes into it, a rule I made was that I could not talk to anyone, could not do a full interview with anyone, which were generally an hour to 2 hours long, that would end up with 3 or 4 minutes in the documentary. I couldn't talk to anyone unless I had read at least one of their books. And so there are a lot of people and a lot of books that I read that didn't fit in. But then going to these people, if any of you computer geeks out there, the documentary is not the finished version, but all the material for it is about 9 terabytes of data. And that's like, you know, more than the history of the world. and with history, a couple quick things. I met Stephen in person for the first time more than a decade ago. And he came in, and we were working on Joey Giambra, a great actor and person of the history of Buffalo. Steve came over here and said, you know, he made some suggestions about the script, and it was wonderful. And for those who don't know, we were filming at the Student Union at Buffalo State University a year ago or whenever.
Yeah.
And it seems like most people don't know the name Stephen McKinley Henderson. But then they see him and they go, oh, that guy, loved that guy. But and the wisdom and the piece, the great works of theater and movies that were written for him are amazing. But when we were at Buff State, there was a few minute break between takes, and a guy came up to him, mid-30s maybe, and said, I work here at Buff State. And forgive me for telling you this, sir, but are you aware that you're the spitting image of Stephen McKinley Henderson? when I started, this was post post the 2000 presidential election,
right.
2020. And so the idea of history and history being lost or not remembered was something that was centered to my mind, but I didn't think it was as important as it is today. example, there's a famous photograph that isn't in the documentary because we felt that too many people had already seen it. Mm. We need to provide new stuff of a formerly enslaved black man, mature, with his back to the camera and just whiplashes the horrible welts and devastation to his body. That's something that was in the National Archives. And I heard yesterday that that photograph, that proof, had been taken down from our federal website. Stephen mentioned the top shooting here in Buffalo in 2022. The present FBI director, Kash Patel, when being questioned by Congress yesterday, said when asked that he didn't know who the shooter was. The director of the FBI did not know who this mass murderer, convicted mass murderer from 3 years ago, didn't recognize the name, that we bury history when it doesn't fit us. And to me, this really isn't a history piece. It's that most, if not all, of our social ills today have antecedents that go all the way back to 400 years ago. So it's not about history. It's about how we got here. And now it's up to us to decide what we're going to do from here.
Let's maybe just take some time then to just kind of go through. First of all, I want to mention that there is going to be a sneak preview coming up at the North Park Theater on Saturday the 27th, 11:30 in the morning, to see It Is Up to Us. With the producers, Stephen Rosenthal and Stephen McKinley Henderson. So Stephen Rosenthal, just like you kind of got into the origins, but I see you have it broken down into some various sections. The Constitution is a part of this. Bring us into what you see, because now you're taking a look at it through your lens, of what you see as this reality of what we have here. We've already talked about how things are already getting buried. You brought up a couple of very disturbing examples just in your last comments, but let's talk about how you brought that in and how you brought it in with your various guests throughout the program.
Well, the law of the land, our foundational piece, is the Constitution. And the documentary started out as national in scope, and I hope it is. Buffalo became more and more of a character. And part of it is a number of the people are nationally known and are not from Buffalo. But I was listening to a radio show here in Buffalo called Buffalo What's Next a number of years ago. And there was a gentleman named Miles Gresham. I've got an awful memory for names. And
You have a lot of them in here, so that has a lot
to
do with it.
Yes, and wonderful. And he talked about the Constitution. And there's also a nationally known the person who actually wrote the law books on voting rights in this country, the one that the students study, you know, that you see in the law libraries, a guy named Professor James Gardner. And James happens to be on the faculty at the University of Buffalo. And so he's in there talking about it. And by the way, Miles was a student of James. And James also happens to be a professional quality jazz pianist, for whatever that's worth.
Nice.
But the idea of getting people to talk about their expertise, but how it relates to all of us in our daily lives in ways that I didn't realize. So there are all these connections. A lot of the people in it know each other. If you want, I can give a quick list of some of the people that.
Please.
Of course, Stephen. Brendan McDuffie, who was a longtime president of the Buffalo Urban League. Pat Sullivan, who's a scholar on civil rights law, and she's written a number of books that have won awards. She's at the University of Southern California. Sam McGavern, who's on the law faculty at UB and also the founder of a public partnership for the public good. Many people know him. People like Dr. Kenyani Davis, who's on the medical faculty at UB and talks about the disparities in health, not because of our biology, but because of our environment and the social environment as well as the physical environment. Several poets, wonderful Carl Bailey and Jillian Hainsworth, who was the founding Buffalo Poet Laureate, and just wonderful. And it was important to us to have poetry and music in this as well as people talking about the history. Henry Louis Taylor, Cary Grant and Deborah Ransom, Andrea Nero, who's a historian of science and here in Buffalo, but she studied at Harvard. Richard Rothstein, the author of the fundamental book on the history of federal segregation. It goes on and on, but just wonderful people, a number of whom, Jerome Wright, Jerome, you've heard of the HALT Act that outlaws solitary confinement. And Jerome and I have talked, a number of these people, their whole story didn't fit into this documentary. So there are new documentaries that we're working on, and he's just... If people could sit down and talk with him, they would change their lives.
One of the most profound individuals I've had a chance to sit down to. There's no doubt
about
that. He's
the real thing.
Absolutely. I want to turn this to Stephen McKinley Henderson in this regard. So as you're talking to Stephen Rosenthal about the guests, and as you mentioned, a few of them have been on this program, and you know, one of the things that, you know, as the host, these are individuals who've helped edify me, understand things, bring new levels of understanding to the realities of Buffalo and of the United States as well. But for you, Stephen McKinley Henderson, you've got you and I are probably about the same age about, but you know, you've lived this in a variety of ways. You're here from Buffalo. I'm wondering, as you are going through this process, helping with this documentary, if there are things that you continue to new understandings, new insights that you're gaining, or perhaps maybe even better, what this particular documentary are going to highlight, these types of understandings that are going to be highlighted?
Well, you know, there's so many moments of enlightenment. The voting rights, which is really, really important. And this is why this gerrymandering that's going on today, this is a historic event. You know, this is something that we knew from a whole other perspective. We thought was gone, you know. And the medical profession to understand really that slavery in its origin could not have really happened without the alignment of the medical profession. To really say that this individual's body is different from yours, that you, this is a whole different category of human being, that the brain weighs such and such, that the, this and that. Now, of course, you get all the way to South Africa and you realize that all the experiments that went on with the heart and transplants and all that sort of stuff, they had real people to try this on. Mm. So all of a sudden, when you can really save a life, then you realize, that black, the parts of a black body and the parts of a white body are indeed interchangeable, and that blood can suddenly the rules change, but they change for the people at the top. So that's it comes the wealth gap. But the thing, and in the incarceration thing, we're talking about with Jerome, you know, was I've had relatives who have been a part of you got mixed up in the justice system and ended up incarcerated. And to understand, when I was young, they would say, you know, there's black time and there's white time. Mm. And the hardest time to serve is black time. This was word on the street knowledge. You know, this is stuff that we absolutely knew because of relatives who had experienced it. But for me personally, the housing circumstance, I talk about it in the documentary. Stephen thought it was worth telling, but the urban renewal, which James Baldwin said Negro removal, they called it urban renewal, but it was really Negro removal, and that affected my whole journey. You know, as a, you know, I where you people could own property and then they take it and then move to another place, they take that. And it finally, they scatter families just like they did before. And now today we have masked people on the streets taking and you realize that's really changing a child's whole trajectory of their life when that grandparent or parent is taken away. These things that I know I've been very fortunate to survive some of the social traumas that came along in my lifetime, but urban renewal was one of the things that left it impossible to have accumulated wealth,
right?
So these things in the documentary really moved me. I also can remember as a child hearing about one particular lynching in Oklahoma when I went down there, and it was to be in the house when the people came in and, you know, had come from finding someone and taking them down. And, you know, it's incredible the facts that Stephen brings out in the documentary about when the first federal law banning lynching, but the year that happened, even though people have been trying to do it for many years. But what year was it, Stephen?
I actually, people need to come to the
see it.
You want to be a spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert. Yeah.
One of my favorite stories in doing this and thinking about it for years, the question, when was the first federal anti-lynching law passed? And almost everyone would say, oh, a lot more recently than we thought, probably. And then they guess anywhere from 1920 to 1970.
Right.
Yeah,
Well, again, it highlights, you know, these things. Like you were saying, Stephen McKinley Henderson, earlier about the idea that history can get and is often pushed aside, especially that which seems to be maybe a little more uncomfortable for certain people than others. But to that, one piece of history that has popped up here in our notes, the Kerner Commission. Tell me about the Kerner Commission.
Doing research and I remember, I'm old enough to remember the Kerner Commission, but reading it again, the awful thing was that things that were written in 1967 sound like they were aspirational for 2025.
Mm.
And that I've had some white people see early versions of the documentary and say, well, this is okay, but why? It's going too fast. It's moving too fast. Where it changes too much. People need to calm down a little bit. And it's like, okay, are you talking about 2000? Are you talking about 1960? Are you talking about 1930? Are you talking about 1900? Are you talking about 1865? You know, this has been too fast in those people's minds forever. And what we're losing is a society, the brilliance that we're losing because we decide that some people don't have a right to the kind of education, or even when they do brilliant things, those things are stolen from them. So,
yeah, and the thing is, that the greatness in America is the fact that it is moving forward. There is no great place to go back to. Okay, the great thing about America is its accumulation, that how it learns from its history, and if we stop that, then we're taking all the greatness out of America. Anybody that's looking to take you back somewhere, the only reason to go back is to learn where you want to go, you know,
right,
that you want to improve. And it's the when you talk about the Constitution really is trying to indeed lay down a pattern to help us become, as I say, to form a more perfect union, to get better at it. But there was a, at the time of the Constitution, really, nobody would want, if you want to be a literalist about the Constitution, then there are these points that are positive, but there are things that we absolutely, the Constitution says, don't stay here. The three-fifths clause, you know, that was a compromise that had to happen in order to form the country. And it was already, it was regrettable at the time it was done by most of the people, but they knew that this was not to stand. This was not to, to stand. There's the idea of the potential. One of the things that I really love finding out about, because I didn't know, that the word slavery is not mentioned anywhere in the Constitution. It was. Thomas Jefferson had written something to say that the King of England gate left us this terrible burden. This is something that we must, you know, eradicate. We have to get rid of this. But they didn't allow that to be put in the Constitution, that statement that he was making. And no one better to make it than Jefferson himself, actually. But most of our founding fathers, all of them, were slave owners. You know? But they were men who were saying, this cannot stand. This is helping the nation be built. And it was literally built on that free labor. And so to understand that attention must be paid, something is owed to the children that are you know, without education, without, you know, that are growing up in poverty and so on and so forth. They need to, and that it hurts both children, both the white and the black child, to not know what the real history is and to know that together is what we could build here. I think about the greatness of the friendship. I happen to have had the great opportunity to meet Muhammad Ali. And the friendship between Ali and Cosell was an important thing for America to experience on television. And it was an important thing for him to experience. And I had also, Ali said that he received one of his robes that when he was trying to go from Cassius Clay to Muhammad Ali, and they were not acknowledging it. And he received a robe from Elvis Presley that said Muhammad Ali. And that the colonel didn't want any of that to be. So there are things about history that's not recorded. There are certain things that are oral tradition that only one person tells another person. And our real connection, the real friendships that exist. They talk about the friendship between Joe Louis and Max Smelling, that these are things that are very important for us to cherish, really, the potential in this country and the bridges that are already built. That's why when Stephen reached out to me, I was just thrilled to know that there was a citizen that I could get to meet who had been doing this marvelous work and had accumulated all these great people, and they were all speaking the truth to power, so to speak. And it wasn't like some sort of it wasn't a political pursuit. It was just recognizing that we have to know exactly where we come from to get on where we're bound. And we are bound for greatness. It's not that we, you know, or looking backward to great, we are, America is bound for greatness. We got to keep on using the positive pillars that are left for us. And so when you hear Cory Booker, or you hear people speaking out and simply saying, this can't stand, you know, it just cannot stand. And it doesn't have to do with Republican or Democrat, as far as I'm concerned. It just has to do with Americans.
We are here on remote today on What's Next. And we're very pleased to be with the producers of It Is Up to Us. But the documentary is going to have a sneak preview this coming Saturday, the 27th, at the North Park. at 11:30 with us, Stephen McKinley Henderson and Stephen Rosenthal, the producers of It Is Up to Us. I'm going to get off on a little tangent. I don't want to, but I think it falls very much into this documentary. Stephen McKinley Henderson, earlier in your comments, you mentioned how people fear history. And I'm going to open that up as a conversation between the both of you to that extent. Why do people fear history? What can we do? This documentary might be a good example of how the fear of history can be overcome. Let's just talk about that a little bit. Stephen Rosenthal, what are your thoughts about it? We're taking Stephen McKinley Henderson's words here, but when he said that, I thought that it's a fascinating topic, the fear of history.
I think that history, the shaping of history, shapes the present and the future, and that there's a whole, the phrase, difficult conversations. Mm-hmm. One of the highest hopes for this documentary is that people will see it. I haven't shown it to anyone, including myself, who hasn't said, wow, I didn't know that about that. That makes a difference. What we hope is that we're going to have sincere conversations among people who don't agree in hopes that to be able to say that profound thing, oh, I understand what you're saying. And that makes me think a little bit differently. And we've lost that civility. I heard a phrase that, you know, we shouldn't argue as sport. We shouldn't argue to win. We should argue to understand and come to consensus. And so we're hoping very much that people will talk to each other about the documentary afterwards. And I think the fear of history is fear of finding out that, gee, things weren't that my ancestors and their legacy, which is me, have to be willing to make some changes. It is up to us to make those changes. Something that I didn't know in the learned in the documentary was the town I was born into was built just after World War II for returning veterans. My dad was a B-29 pilot. And it turned out that it was whites only in perpetuity. If you bought a house there, you could not sell it to anyone except, quote, Caucasian. And that's something that I didn't learn from my folks, not because they were hiding anything, but at that time, that was just the norm. And then to find out, and this isn't in the documentary, but a friend had mentioned that in Buffalo there were housing tracts that were built that were whites only. No one could get mortgages unless you were Caucasian. And it turned out that when I first moved to Buffalo something like 1961 or 62. We lived in that neighborhood. I had no idea. And by the time we lived there, obviously it was a little bit different. But just that this is a soup that we all live in. And lots of people don't want to know the history because if you are willing to believe a fake history, then, you know, gee, white men really are being persecuted, that it's not fair, that, well, look at the actual historical record, and why would I want to talk about that if that hurts me? Well, because in the long run, it may hurt at first, but to live in a society where people can share the good and can be allowed to contribute what good they have is a much better deal. It was a long, verbose answer. Sir.
Well, it was a good answer, and yes, you did touch on it. You're giving me lots of follow-ups, and we're only going to have so much time, but I'm going to go back to you then, Stephen McKinley Henderson. You're the one that used that term, that fear history. What about that for you? I mean, how do you see that?
Well, so from my point of view, there's no reason to fear history because it liberates you. But the children that get picked up on the bus today, they can go into a classroom together and not be sitting there being on opposite sides of anything. That it is their country. So to know our history, to think of it in that way, I know how liberating it is to say, and it's difficult for one person, they would fear this, another person rejoice in it, to never use the term, someone was a slave. People were enslaved. They weren't a slave. They were Africans who were brought to America and enslaved. Now, someone did that. But if you start to talk about them as a slave, it was people who were put in an impossible position. And now if you look at how far that's gone, there are people who will say, the presidency of Barack Obama was one of the highlights of the American narrative, the journey, the fact that the political circumstances, that what we had, our system allowed that to happen. It works. It can happen. Now, some people had a complete reaction to that because they feel, what does this mean? Well, some people might think, if I know history and I know how terribly put upon these people were, then my fear is, my God, if they get power, they're going to do that to us. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's almost a high school kind of mentality.
Absolutely. To
that, but to not understand that, no, this is an evolving, an elevating, an enlightenment. We are becoming something wonderful, that a human being can evolve, that we as a species can evolve, that we can become enlightened and we can do better than our history. So I say there's no reason to fear history, because I do know that there are people out there who do fear it, but we can overcome that and be better for it. I also, when I was teaching acting, I used to use this phrase: if you see a door and it says fear on this side, it says freedom on the other side. You go through that door. And I'm talking about the challenges someone might feel on the stage or something.
Sure.
In character wise. But
it's a great metaphor.
But it's absolutely, freedom is written on the other side of that door that has fear on this side. And I'm not talking about bungee jumping. I mean, I don't know. but in terms of the psychological, I remember the great Dr. Ben Johanan saying, there's this unbroken psychological chain of superiority on some white Americans and an unbroken psychological chain of victimization on the other side. It's not inferiority, because but the sense that always watch out for a man because they're always trying to get you. So we operate from a system of being victim, and this other person operating from a position of being superior. We got to break all that down. And it happened, actually. It was quite something when, after the George Floyd event, the people who were out in the streets together, and not just even here, they were out in the streets around the world about that. Now, that, again, that was a moment, a great moment in America. But somebody got afraid. They said, oh my God, it really is happening. And they got afraid. And so one of the things is they say, sometimes we may have to admit that. There's this wonderful thing we have in the documentary about George Wallace and in his journey of his life. It was amazing where he ended up, you know, the black church that he was a part of and so on and so forth. But where he stood at one point, and then where his granddaughter is, and what she talks to her son about Wallace, to see in the one of the diehard, I mean really hardcore guys, to see the journey in his lifetime, and to see his granddaughter and great grandson, and to see that journey, to understand it's possible to come out of that, and it's possible to not condemn your grandparents. Sometimes people just don't want to. They fear history because they say, "I'm going to learn some stuff." You know, I'm finding our roots. That Henry Louis Gates, he sits down with the people, and I know that there are a lot of people. Right, my name might come up one time. He said, "No, I can't do that guy, man. Can't turn that page on that guy." You know what I mean? You're going to go back and find a whole lot of. But people have overcome incredible things in a single lifetime. In a single lifetime. Someone who go from what Mandela did in his lifetime It's just an incredible situation. So we need to be inspired by that. And America has the power to let a life make its greatest journey. It's ours. It's up to us to really use it for that good, you know.
Well, it makes me think of what you had mentioned in the documentary, early in the documentary. I had the opportunity to get a sneak preview of it. You stated that the documentary aspires to be the tool, to a tool for clarity and response to the tactic of division. And that's clearly what's happening in this world right now.
Yes.
We are having this division. And I'm hoping that people who go to see this will understand the mission behind this documentary. You also stated, and as y'all were having this conversation, I was trying to figure out how can I, you know, come in and just ask this question. And it was pertaining to the quote that you had said in regards to truth-telling citizens.
Yes, well.
To keep the democracy alive.
Yes, yes. Yes.
Who wrote that?
I claim. Yeah, it's absolutely so that there are enough truth-loving citizens to keep democracy alive, no matter how high in office the liars rise.
Yes.
I truly believe that. Now, it's the election process, though, you see. As Malcolm said, it's the ballot or the bullet. And right now, it's the bullet. But it's got to be the ballot. We've got to. And that's why the gerrymandering. There are all these things. We're being set up to get hoodwinked. But there are enough truth-loving citizens to keep democracy alive, no matter how high in office the liars rise. But we've got to go out and do our part as American citizens. And that's why I say it's revolutionary optimism, because you look around and you say, man, the whole thing is fixed. It's fixed here. My greatest dismay is the Supreme Court. That was one of the things that in the terms of the balance of power, in terms of, you know, that was something that you could kind of really, and they did in the past, historically, they have pulled us through a lot of things. Finally, I still try to stay positive, but that court, man, you know, because some people are counting on the court to be on their side.
Yep.
And the court has the power to do what it wants to do. It's not beholden to anyone. They're there and they could do it. It's unfortunate that, they allowed the imbalance in terms of who got to name who and who wasn't able to name a justice because it was election, too close to election, and then who can do that. I mean, all the hypocrisy reveals itself. The court has a chance to say this far and no further, you know, no further. But I thank you though for saying that about the tool, because it is for us to, and we can be proud of America's journey if we allow ourselves to use these tools to get where we can be an example for the world again. Right now, we're not. Well, I'm not even trying to make a point about that. Mm-hmm. I think our documentary, as you say, hopefully we wanted to give people a chance to see that it's still up to us. It's not out of control. It is up to us. And we have these wonderful people who know and have been doing the hard work for a long time. That's mm-hmm. the other thing I love about the documentary is that there are people there who didn't come to this yesterday. They've been fighting for rights for a long time.
Yeah. Stephen Rosenthal, I couldn't help but see you nod emphatically as Stephen McKinley Henderson was answering the question there. And it struck me how I had a conversation the other day about patriotism versus nationalism. I won't get into all of that, but just the idea that, and as Stephen McKinley Henderson was saying, you know, there's a greatness inside this country. And I guess what I'm asking you from your documentary standpoint, where does that fit in? What's that underlying message that you're trying to tell our country about itself, and it is up to us?
I think it was really trying to hold a mirror up to all of us and say, these are the stories we tell about ourselves. Here's the historical record that argues with that. How can we work together to be a more just society? And anything more than that, I've struggled with making this documentary because, you know, who am I to do anything like this? I'm not trained as a journalist.
But yet you kept going forward.
Well, because if you have the tools to communicate, the technical tools, and you don't use them to try and make a better world, then my fondest dream for this documentary is that hundreds of people will see it, and maybe two or three will go, well, I'm going to do it a little differently. And anything more than that is beyond, you know, my sense of what's possible. But you got to try, and you got to just, you know, hold the door open for somebody when you walk in, even when the door doesn't say fear and freedom. I do want to say, Steve has given me credit for working on this for a while, but you've all heard his contribution.
Sure.
And it many, many times more than that. But we've spent several hundred hours together working on that. There are literally millions of decisions to go into, you know, is this color graded just right? Should we cut this a second earlier or later? There are things, some of the most important things to me in this documentary, we had to take out because it didn't fit within the whole music of the thing, the journey of it. I do want to share that the only time that we've had arguments is where Stephen says, I think this should be this way. And then I look at it and say, gee, I thought the opposite. And then we'll argue for 10 minutes. But no, you were right about that. No, I was wrong. You were right about that.
Boy, I wish all arguments in this country can end up like that.
There aren't too many people like Stephen McKinley Henderson.
Well, I tell you.
Don't argue with me.
Pat Sullivan is so wonderful in this documentary. And Jerome Wright. As you say, he's just one of the. There's so many, you know, Dr. Taylor, and there's so many people inside this documentary. This is why I say there are enough truth-loving citizens because they represent, and they've touched all these people, you know, and so there's so much reason to be positive right now in terms of. We really do know, you know, this is not, it's not like, it's not so bad. No, it's bad. It's bad. If there are masked people with ICE going out, taking people out, that's bad. It's bad. And if they're shooting people for having to express their opinion, because, you know, it's absolutely right. The freedom of speech exists and nobody should be taken out for their point of view, but there's the difference between hatred and evil. And so it's evil to foster hatred, to really use that for your own personal ends and to make a profit out of your position in office. There's a difference between, you know, people who are unenlightened, unintelligent, and who simply choose to be, but to organize hatred is evil.
I'm going to leave the revolutionary optimist on his final word there, Stephen McKinley Henderson, and turn the final word here in our last couple of moments of What's Next to you, Stephen Rosenthal. What do you want people to take away from It Is Up to Us?
I'd love to have people take conversations, to have the conversations that hopefully with this stuff will be a little bit easier.
And I hope when they have those conversations, that they turn to arguments, I'm going to throw one of your quotes back to you. Hopefully they're not looking to win. They're looking to understand a little bit more.
That feels so good when it happens.
Absolutely.
When somebody can look at a face and say, you look different from me, but I see myself within you.
There's a lot here. I appreciate your time. And more, is, of course, can be seen this coming Saturday at the North Park, 11:30. It is up to us, a sneak preview. And with us this morning on What's Next, Stephen McKinley Henderson, Stephen Rosenthal, the producers. For our producer, executive producer, Charles Gilbert, I'm Jay Moran, and this is What's Next, in Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, NPR.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.